Isn't it just amazing? Maybe nature is trying to tell us some stuff. For example, on the coasttocoastam.com website, which you should always pay a visit to, scientists say a duck has fathered a chicken. Yes, it's true. That's what they say. Is Earth rarer than we think? It would appear so. Maybe there was life on Mars, but there's nobody walking around, unless maybe that one photograph that looks like somebody trying to duck into the fallout shelter there. If that actually turns out to be a biped. A UFO hovers over airplane in Manitoba. And Voyager solar system exit debated. Not to mention a 400-year-old mummy-making myth. That's on the coasttocoastam.com website. Okay, here's the thing. We have to bring the news to you that no one else will bring on a broad level. A lot of stuff out on the web. Internet's a beautiful thing. A lot of disinformation out there also. Information sickness is a distinct possibility as we try to filter intel from simple information. But I've been watching this for a long time. In contact with people all over the country. And a lot of them are waving their little Geiger counters around. I'm using the words a lot of people are waving their radiation detectors, their little Geiger counters, around the filters that they pull out of their HVAC systems. And they see that there are measurably higher readings of ionizing radiation. These particles have been captured in the filters. There's jewelry coming over, automotive parts, construction materials, and then, of course, no one bothering to tell you brand new prospective homeowner that, by the way, we built plutonium triggers here for fire sets for 70,000 nuclear weapons right here where your hot tub's going to be. So put on your lead Speedo and enjoy. So I invite you to visit my personal website. If you forget what the name of it is, you can go to coasttocoastam.com, go to the host section, drop-down box will appear, select John B. Wells, and then go to the very bottom of that extraordinarily long description of events from the ancient past and a few of the present. And you'll find a link to caravantomidnight.com. It may help you out. It doesn't matter where you get these devices, just as long as you get one. Okay, now, next up, Stephen Starr. His website is nuclearddarkness.org. Notice I did not say nuclear, I said nuclearddarkness.org. Associate member of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and he is our next guest for our third hour here on the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. Let me tell you a little bit about Stephen Starr, an associate member of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. It's been published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. His writings appear on the websites of PSR, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, the Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology Center for Arms Control, Energy and Environmental Studies, Scientists for Global Responsibility, and the International Network of Scientists Against Proliferation. Since 2007, he has worked with the governments of Switzerland, Chile, and New Zealand in support of their efforts at the United Nations to eliminate thousands of high-alert, launch-ready nuclear weapons. Mr. Starr is also an expert on the environmental consequences of nuclear war, as it stands in stark contrast to assurances that nuclear war is survivable. Well, surviving a cockroach can survive, but do you want to live like a roach? In 2011, he made an address to the UN General Assembly describing the dangers that nuclear weapons and nuclear war poses to all nations and peoples. He has made presentations to ministry officials, parliamentarians, universities, citizens, and students from around the world, and specializes in making technical scientific information understandable to all audiences. Tonight, we're going to talk with him about commercial nuclear reactors, just like the one at Fukushima. They are, in fact, according to Mr. Starr, nuclear war in a can. Welcome, Stephen Starr.
Hi, John. Thanks very much for having me.
I got a question that's been dogging me for years. Why does anybody need 70,000 nuclear weapons in their arsenal?
Why do we need one? You know, it's
point taken.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think most people don't even realize that there's still thousands of warheads that can be launched within a few minutes. And I'm not even convinced that the leaders of the nuclear weapon states are aware of what the environmental consequences would be of the use of these weapons, which the peer-reviewed studies now show that would, you know, even a war between India and Pakistan could cause this catastrophic disruptions in global climate and wind up causing global nuclear famine.
Yeah, a few years ago, India and Pakistan were going, we'll show those underground rock formations a thing or two, and they were just blowing these things off one after another. Pakistan is a nuclear-armed nation? Seems inconceivable.
Yeah, they actually have a big nuclear arms race going on there. There are about more than 200 operational nuclear weapons. Their weapons are about the size of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Japan and Nagasaki. Those are sort of entry-level nuclear weapons. The studies that I referred to, they had a baseline of 100 of those weapons going off, 50 in each one of the cities of India and Pakistan. And they found that it would put about 5 million tons of soot above cloud level in the stratosphere. In 2 weeks, it circles the Earth, and in a couple of months, it forms like a global stratospheric smoke layer, would block enough sunlight to cause the coldest average surface temperatures in the last 1,000 years in the Northern Hemisphere. And so clearly, that's going to affect crops, and they predict that up to 1 billion people could die from starvation just from a war like that. And those weapons represent less than 1% of the explosive power and the launch-ready weapons that the U.S. and Russia still have ready to go at a moment's notice.
I'm thinking Iran. I don't want to get too far afield here, as the expression goes, but I got a feeling Iran's about 15 minutes away from their weapon if they don't already have it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in favor of anybody having nuclear weapons, but, you know, and North Korea, Pakistan, Iran, but, you know, really 95% of the weapons are still maintained and by the United States and Russia. And that's actually where the threat to human existence really comes from in terms of if there's any significant use of those, it's going to be the end of history for us.
Stephen, tell us a little bit about you. What led you to this work?
Well, that's a good question. I actually was in nuclear engineering in college, and that was way back, you know, in the middle of the last century sometime. But I was worried about nuclear weapons when I was in third grade and they had the Cuban Missile Crisis. But, you know, they told us that nuclear power was going to be too cheap to meter. But what threw me off on the power was when they started explaining that they were developing sign language to put on decommissioned nuclear reactors so that, you know, if civilization collapsed, then maybe 600,000 years from now would keep someone from trying to get into it. And that worried me. I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. So I went into biological sciences, but I always maintained an interest in the subject and wound up kind of becoming an expert in it over the years.
Which gets your which makes the biggest blip on your scope, so to speak, the weapons or the power plants?
Well, you know, I focused on you gave me quite a nice introduction there about the weapons, and I mean that's the way to quickly end. You know, within an hour we could basically destroy civilization and create enough long-term environmental damage to probably make it impossible for most people to survive on the planet, just even without the blast and the fire, that you wouldn't be able to grow crops for probably 10 years at least. But when the anniversary of Chernobyl came around, I started studying that, and I learned a number of things that really shocked me. There's over 1,000 square miles around the Chernobyl reactor that's in a radioactive exclusion zone where no one can live, and most people don't realize that. But then when I studied it more, I found that there's many tens of thousands of square miles that were heavily contaminated, particularly in Belarus and the Ukraine. And there's a story about, I spent the last year working on translating as a general editor for a translation of a study that was done on the effects of the routine ingestion of cesium-137 and contaminated foodstuffs. And So, you know, there's a lot. I've come to think of nuclear powers being sort of like nuclear war in slow motion, and it's because that each reactor produces much higher levels of quantities, percentages of long-lived radioactive isotopes, even than a bomb does. So we've been piling this stuff up for decades now, and you know, inside the reactor, there's the equivalent of hundreds of times the amount of radioactivity that would long-lived radioisotopes that would have been produced by a Hiroshima bomb. But even worse, the spent fuel that's taken out of the reactor every 18 months, it goes into a spent fuel pool next to the reactor. None of these pools are inside primary containment, and they contain many times more radioactivity. It's so each one of these commercial power plants is sort of like this gigantic radiologic time bomb that we've neatly dotted around there's 104 plants in the U.S. and over 400 globally. And I view that as an equal threat to human existence and complex life as I do nuclear war.
Really? Now, I heard a little I haven't followed it up yet. When I get a minute, I will. But did you hear anything to the effect that President Carter back in the day, there was a way to neutralize the spent fuel rods?
Well, I
Talk
wish there
about that.
was. You know, I've looked at some different things I've been sent leads on, but honestly, there's no simple fix to this. I really wish there was because we've made an enormous problem. You know, even if all these reactors work perfectly, which obviously they haven't, we still are creating this waste that has to be isolated from the biosphere for 100,000 to 1 million years, and that, I mean, that's such a great length of time, it's almost beyond human comprehension. And you know, I'd like to explain how toxic this stuff is. Is it okay if I do that?
Absolutely.
Well, the main radionuclide that's caused all the problems after Chernobyl and Fukushima is called cesium-137. It's radioactive cesium, and it's got a 30-year half-life. But it gets widely distributed when there's a reactor melts down, or in a fuel pool boils off, and the fuel rods are ruptured or melted. It forms a gas inside the rods. It's very volatile. Cesium becomes a liquid at 82 degrees. So these rods heat up to like 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. Most of the cesium becomes a gas or an aerosol. Well, I found that a piece of like 1.2 grams of cesium, and an American dime's more than about 2 grams. But so half the size of a dime. If you make that into an aerosol and you spread it over a square mile, that square mile will become as radioactive as the exclusion zone surrounding Chernobyl. It's
My God.
uninhabitable for, you know, a century or two at least.
That little.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it? But it's because there, you know, you have to think in nuclear terms. In 1 gram of cesium, there's as many atoms as there are in all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the world. And out of those, there's 1,480 trillion of those are disintegrating every second. So you spread that over a square mile, it means every square yard, there's about 1.5 million atoms that are disintegrating. And when they disintegrate, they give off huge amounts of energy at the atomic level in terms of, you know, the real danger of this, though, what the industry hasn't addressed, the radiation safety standards, I think, don't really adequately address, is what happens if you ingest these. And that's, I mentioned Belarus. What they found is the stuff bioaccumulates in humans. And that's, if you go to the US EPA website, that's not what it says. It says it's uniformly distributed in human tissue. But they did more than 400 autopsies, primarily on infants and children, because that's who it gets the worst. And children also suffer many times worse effects than adults do because they're growing faster and the stuff, you know, gets into their bodies and really messes up the cells that are busy, you know, dividing and the DNA. So,
Sure, which is permanently altered.
yeah. So if you're a poor person and you live in one of these contaminated areas and you're growing your, you live, you know, you have a garden, you live on the foodstuffs that are grown there, the cesium's water soluble. You dump a bunch of this, like in Japan, almost 12,000 square miles got cesium dumped on it from the disaster at Fukushima. It, you know, blew around and it rained out. And so when it gets into the soil, it becomes ubiquitous. It gets into the soil, the water, the plants, the animals. And, you know, when you're talking at the atomic level, it gets into everything. So it gets in, and so you start out just like DDT. There can be like really low concentrations, but as the plants absorb it, if they can't excrete it faster than they absorb it, then it accumulates in them. And then, you know, something eats them and something eats them. And the predators always wind up with the highest concentrations of all these toxins. So, and there's some food stuff because cesium's in the same atomic family as potassium. There's some, like mushrooms are the best example. They're very rich in potassium. So they absorb large amounts of cesium. The mushrooms are terrible. You know, don't eat any mushrooms from Japan or Russia. So people that live there, and particularly kids, they eat the stuff every day. They eat all their food's going to have radioactivity in it if they live in these contaminated areas. And some of it's going to have more than others. The mushrooms and berries have the most. And then, you know, meat and dairy products are going to be more highly concentrated. So these kids get sick. Less than 20% of the children in these contaminated areas are considered healthy now in Belarus, and less than 40% in Ukraine. And that's hundreds of thousands of children that are sick. But, you know, you don't hear about that, do you?
Wait a second. Let me have those percentages again.
Yeah, less than 20% of the children. There's a couple hundred thousand children in Belarus that are considered they're sick. And it's primarily from you know, eating contaminated food. The government, I mean, there's a hell of a story with this. The guy that, in 1991, there's a pathologist named Yuri Bandachevsky, and he was a director of the Gomel State Medical Institute, and he did research for 9 years. They worked with this Belrad Institute. They did whole body counts in these kids. You can measure how much radioactivity is inside the cesium-137 that's inside a child or any person, because when cesium disintegrates, it breaks down into barium that emits gamma radiation. And gamma radiation passes through the body. So you can set somebody on they call it a whole body counter. It could be like a little chair, or there's different designs, but they can quantitate. They can measure how much cesium there is in the body based on the gamma rays that are coming out. So then they divide the body weight of the person by the atomic disintegrations per second. And they can figure out how much is in each person. And they did this for, like 100,000 kids. They measured this, and they correlated all these different pathologies. They're diseases of old age. They're not just cancers and leukemias, but they have these 12-year-old kids that are having strokes and heart attacks. And, they found that it bioaccumulates very strongly in the heart and the endocrine tissues. And so ultimately it makes them sick. And they had a program to get the kids out of the country. I think they're still doing it somewhat, to get them someplace where they can get what they call clean food and get to flush the stuff out of the body. It takes about 110 days to get half of it out. But at any rate, after 9 years, Bandachevsky, he wrote up a report. He gives it to all the members of the Belarus parliament and the dictator, Lukashenko. He goes home and they arrest him and they throw him in prison. And they go to his medical institute and they destroy all of his archived samples and slides. Because he was fighting them to try to resettle people in these contaminated areas. And they moved all the people back. They ultimately put him in prison for 6 years. They even tortured the poor guy. So he's in exile in France. And that was it was a report that he wrote that I just worked on trying to get a decent English translation. He managed to write a report when he was at home under house arrest for a number of months. But it was never published. You know, it was basically suppressed for probably 9 or 10 years, I guess, longer than that. And it's a story that needs to be told, because I'm afraid that, you know, the same story is going to repeat itself in Japan and any place else where there's a disaster and the cesium gets into the soil.
That's why we are delighted to have you as our first-time guest, Stephen Starr. We'll take our little break and come back, Stephen. Stand by, will you? This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, our first-time guest tonight is Stephen Starr, and we're going to get into just how poisonous is this stuff. You know, the cesium-137 was discovered in the bluefin tuna that were caught right off the California coast some months ago. But gee, not a peep out of the mainstream media have we found anymore. The latest thing that we've heard are that the seals are looking like skeletons trying to walk around on their little flippers, and it's just really kind of sad. But look, this is a problem. We need to be aware of it. We need to contact the responsible parties and make sure that they are responsible. All right, let's take our quick little break and get right back with Stephen Starr on Coast to Coast AM. NuclearDarkness.org is his website. Stephen Starr, I asked Arne Gunderson this question earlier in the first hour, and I want to ask you, why is the world not rushing to Japan to try to put a sock in this thing's mouth?
Because I think the world's been informed that the crisis is over. Corporate media has pretty much gave the impression some time ago that everything was under control, but that's not the case.
All right. Then one more time, bring us back up to speed. Cesium-137, that's not a naturally occurring element. It's a byproduct?
Yes, it's a fission product, and it actually, it's never occurred. We didn't evolve with this stuff. There hasn't been any cesium-137 around while complex life was evolving on Earth. And it's 10 million times more radioactive than, say, like the potassium-40, the naturally occurring radionuclides that you would find like in a banana. So per unit volume, it's just greatly, it's much more radioactive. So it's the kind of thing you certainly don't want in your food. And, right. You know, you mentioned, you know, that if you look at the acceptable levels of radioactivity, and cesium was going to be the thing that really probably we should focus on, because it's a long-lived radionuclide. Once it gets out, it doesn't go away very quickly, and it builds up, it bioaccumulates and biomagnifies in the food chain. So that's why the tuna are showing up with it. So Japan's acceptable level is anything more than 100 becquerels per kilogram. A becquerel is one atomic disintegration per second. So anything that's got 100 atomic disintegrations per second or more, that's too radioactive. But it turns out the U.S. limits are 1,200. So, you know, think about that. What does that mean? That means if you're over there in Japan, you say, okay, we're going to keep the stuff that's less than 100, and the greater than 100 goes to the United States. And, you know, I want to mention, too, I learned at the symposium I spoke at there in New York that Helen Cullicott put on at the New York Academy of Medicine. Cindy Folkers with Beyond Nuclear, they're getting a initiative going where they're going to petition the change from 1,200 becquerels per kilogram to 5 becquerels per kilogram acceptable radiation and foodstuffs in the U.S. And I think that's an important concept. Because as I mentioned, you know, about the kids, the stuff builds up in infants and children. There was a graph that we showed there that if you ingest 10 becquerels per day of radiation, in about 3 years, your whole body count gets up to 1,400 becquerels. So if you're at those levels, if you're a child, then you're going to be at the same levels where they found pathologies developing in children in Belarus. But the radiation safety standards that we use now don't recognize that. So that's another problem we have.
Can you flush this stuff out completely?
You can, but it takes time. And the problem is if someone that lives in a contaminated area, which these are vast areas that were contaminated in Belarus and Ukraine, and even Europe had big spots. But if you can't afford to get what they would call clean food that doesn't have radioactivity in it, then if you eat it every day, it builds up in your body. So what they do is they send the kids that they can afford to send out of the country to like a sanatorium in France and Germany, and then they can try to get the stuff out. But it's a terrible thing when the stuff gets into an ecosystem. I also learned at the symposium that I hadn't even thought of it, but if most of the people in these areas use wood to cook with and to heat, well, the wood's radioactive. So when you burn the wood, it makes radioactive smoke. So, I mean, it just goes to show you, we can't let the stuff loose. And when it just as little as 1 gram can make a square mile uninhabitable, you know, that's the other point I want to make, is that every nuclear power plant we have in the U.S. probably has a ton of this stuff sitting in a spent fuel pool or more, enough to make, you know, thousands of square miles uninhabitable, more than that. So that's a big problem, because none of these fuel pools, they store the used fuel rods, they call it spent nuclear fuel. None of them are in the primary containment. They're all outside of it. And there's 23 reactors that are, maybe Arne mentioned this, I don't know, but 23 reactors that are the same design as those at Fukushima, and the fuel pools are actually above ground level. The top of the pool is 100 feet above ground. It makes them very dangerous, really. They're more vulnerable to terrorism, for example. And all you have to do is breach that pool. Once the water goes out of that pool, those rods will heat up. Any rods that are less than 5 years out of the core will ignite and burn. They'll certainly rupture. And then you've got massive release of cesium.
You know, just a couple of guys talking here. Philosophically speaking, Stephen, what is wrong with the leadership in this country? They're either building these massive numbers of weapons, and then when they see that something that was designed to run the refrigerator and the air conditioner and the lights and all that stuff, this thing melts down, turns into a real monster that threatens to bite them on the backside. They seem to do nothing. I mean, is there some sort of a possibility somewhere that it's like, well, we're going to have 2 billion more people on the planet soon, so what difference does it make if we lose a few million?
Yeah, it's hard not to start wondering those kind of things. I mean, I don't see how anybody can call nuclear power safe and clean when, you know, every day they create just enormous amounts more every day. You know, that's, I mean, even if we shut all the reactors down tomorrow, we still have something like 70,000 tons of the spent nuclear fuel that we got to do something with.
I wonder what the money is on that to try and maintain those pools for the next million years or whatever.
Yeah, well, I don't think they figure that in when they talk about how, you know, cost-effective it is. The nuclear industry basically has isolated the one part of the whole process where they can make money. They make $1 to $2 million per day on every reactor that runs. That's profit, you know. And that's why they want to keep them running. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is really like the NRC, really, I think stands for the Non-Regulatory Commission, they're giving them like a blank check to, you know, 20, and they're even talking about 40-year extensions on plants that were designed to be operated for 40 years at the most. They're talking 6 year, 80 years. And I mean, that's just crazy. You know, that guarantees there's going to be some terrible, you know, I mean, it's almost unthinkable, but yet these guys have blinders on. I went to a hearing in Kansas City. They had occasionally they'll have a hearing where they'll invite the public. They'll announce it a day or two ahead of time and put it out in the middle of nowhere so nobody can find it.
So nobody shows up,
yeah,
right?
I was FEMA and the NRC, and they were talking about expanding the evacuation zones around power plants from 10 miles to greater. I mean, you know, remember Obama told everybody in Japan, the Americans, to go 50 miles away. But then I think they wished they hadn't done that. So I went and I asked the guys from the NRC, I said, in your calculations for this process, are you going to consider a disaster at the spent fuel pool, or are you only looking at the reactor? Well, they wouldn't answer my question. They said, well, sorry, we don't want to answer that. Any other questions?
We don't want to answer that.
They wouldn't answer. So I did notice that all the people from FEMA actually seemed pretty interested, because I think they're the ones that might have to clean up after it. Although you can't really. That's even, you know, remember in Japan, there's about 300 square miles where nobody can go. You can't live there. And there's 159,000 people that are permanent refugees there, and then they'll never go home. They'll never have their homes again. So even if the industry is going to say, oh, nobody got hurt, nobody got sick, but they can't back away from the fact that there's still this 300 square miles where nobody can live. And, you know, it's, I don't know. I just shake my head like you when I see all this. It doesn't make any sense, except money's, it's so profitable. It's, there's the mining industry, there's the enrichment process, there's the reactors, and there's also weapons. I mean, it's all kind of interrelated, really, when it comes down to it.
It's, you know, not going away, is it?
No. I mean, you know, one thing people should understand, reactors were designed to make plutonium. They weren't designed to make electricity.
Right.
And there's a lot better ways to boil water than this. Because
that's what
they do. They boil water. They don't make some kind of magical nuclear electricity. They just boil water. They produce heat. But they produce, when they shut down a reactor, there's still a huge, the fission, it takes days and days to cool it down. So they have to keep running the cooling system. Like at Fukushima, they couldn't. And so it melted down. It melted the core. It blew up, basically. And, you know, again, like I thought the Soviets were bad, but then when I see what the Japanese did, they tracked the radiation going over the entire country, and they didn't warn anybody. I found these slides from Lawrence Livermore that show a direct plume going from Fukushima over Tokyo. 50 million people. And Arne Gundersen, when he spoke there in New York, he, you know, the radioactive gases, it's not just cesium that gets out. They're the noble gases. They have huge amounts of radioactivity. There was like 1,300 becquerels per cubic meter of air in Tokyo for a day or two. And they didn't tell anybody. People are walking around in the streets. The kids are playing. And I think there's going to be huge health problems just from that, let alone all the contamination that's going to remain in the soils and the waters there.
Do we have any evidence to suggest that we've had releases over here and our government said nothing?
Well, I tell you, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't have any. Well, I know that in the past that there were releases they did experimentally. Well, if you want to look at the worst releases, look at the atmospheric weapons test they did in Nevada. You know, we had 104 above-ground nuclear detonations. It was like we had a nuclear war here. Just the bombs went off in the desert, but the radioactive fallout went all over. The National Cancer Institute did a study that they finally released in the late 1990s, and they showed this from the iodine-131 that there's something like 50,000 people got thyroid cancer from that. The whole Midwest was blanketed with this stuff. And but it wasn't just the Midwest. It was New York State, Florida, California got a bit, Louisiana. So I honestly think that was probably one of the worst environmental disasters in the American history, but nobody knows about it because, you know, radiation's invisible. You know, that's what's weird about it. You can be in a just most beautiful pastoral setting, but if you get your Geiger counter out, then it can go crazy. You know, we have no way to sense this stuff. So I get kind of worked up. I understand. I probably sound, but it really is horrifying. The more I've studied this, it is hard to believe, and it bothers me. The thing that bothers me the most is when I see all these sick kids. That's what really got me involved in trying to work on these translations from Belarus. When I saw all these videos, there's so many sick kids over there. I think the people that promote the stuff that say it's so safe and clean should go over and visit some of these pediatric hospitals that are full of kids with malformations and cancers and leukemias. And then, you know, they should see that. They should have to come face to face with it instead of pretending like the stuff is safe.
You know, I'm just reading an email here from Janine, and she said she lives in rural central Missouri at the Lake of the Ozarks. The summer after the Fukushima accident, she began to find native weeds that were sprouting white and green variegated leaves. This never happened before or since, but not until much later. And
well, there's a study. There's a blog. There's some pretty good scientists here, and they did a study. They showed that there was a spike in cesium-137 and grass-fed beef here in Missouri a year after Fukushima. So it certainly did get over here. These are not localized things. You know, the winds, it not only will it blow smoke from nuclear detonations, but it'll blow, you know, the stuff. We're in a biosphere that, you know, these things go all around the globe. And surely, I mean, obviously it's going to be a lot higher concentrations elsewhere, but when this stuff is lethal at the atomic level. So all it takes is one mutation to cause a cancer. You can't minimize this stuff. And even using the current standards that they have now, just for that are more based on external exposure than internal, you can show statistically how many more cancers you're going to have per 100,000. But like, for example, in Japan, they raised the acceptable levels 20 times. You know, they decided they couldn't evacuate 5,000 square miles over there. So they just said, okay, we're going to raise the acceptable exposure standards times 20. But you can use the National Academy of Sciences data to show that that's going to cause an extra 1,000 cancers for every 100,000 people for female infants and children just from external exposures. And that doesn't count internal.
Oh, boy. Hey, you feel like taking a call?
Sure, whatever you like.
Let's take one. Stephen, let's talk to Stephen in Statesville, North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hello, Stephen. Speak with Stephen and me.
Yeah, I was just wondering about produce that we get, say, from California, San Joaquin Valley, and also as the radiation precipitates out, across the United States. What about the grass, the cattle that feed on that, and the like you mentioned earlier, it was showing up in the meat, and what about the milk, though? Also, is there something that we can take to chelate that out of our bodies? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Stephen.
Well, those are all good questions. I don't have any direct evidence to tell you what exposure levels there are, but I think I mentioned earlier, Cindy Folkers at Beyond Nuclear, they're setting up an initiative to try to get the FDA to lower their acceptable levels from 1,200 to 5 becquerels per kilogram. And, you know, I think in a way that might be the thing to direct your attention to, just to try to get public awareness of this, to make them address this in a way that's useful. I guess in terms of chelating, I don't know about that. I will tell you, I read studies that were done in Belarus. They developed a apple pectin type material with a bunch of different minerals and vitamins. I know that's been in dispute, but what they did was they had these kids at these sanatoriums and they did whole body counts on them, and I trust the methodology they used for that, and they found that the kids that got a certain number of grams of this pectin plus the vitamins every day seemed to clear the cesium faster than the kids that didn't get it. They had a 40% reduction in kids that were getting the pectin supplements versus about 16% with the kids that didn't. So I think there may be some ways to do this, but I'm not really an expert in it, and I only have read about it.
You know what? We could talk for 3 hours. I wish we had 3 hours, but let me ask you this: as we're down to about 2.5 minutes here.
Okay.
That was a quick hour, Stephen. I'm not kidding you either. And thanks so much for consenting
to
this
interview. Well, I can talk. I know that.
No, me too. I'd rather listen to you though. What has your attention as a potential trouble spot in this country? We got the San Onofre thing. We got the Rocky Flats discussion. We got the Hanford storage facility up in Washington State. That thing's leaking.
I would like to say. I'd also like to say I'm a senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility. And they have a very good document. It's called On Hardened On-Site Storage. And I mentioned all these spent fuel pools that are at every single reactor has had to store all its used fuel on-site ever since it got started. And these pools are filled to the brim with enormous amounts of this, you know, incredibly toxic stuff. And what they really need to do, once a rod's been underwater for 5 years or so, they can actually they can get a lot of these rods out of the pool. They cool down enough where they can put them into a dry cast storage, and they can harden that so that it doesn't have to be cooled by water. It could be air cooled, and when it's hardened, it's not susceptible to a terrorist attack. You can hit it with an airplane or an explosive, an RPG, and it won't disperse. And so, if they could get probably 2/3 of the 3/4 of the rods out of the pools and into the storage, and it would greatly decrease the consequences of a catastrophic release of radiation. And that's something that you know, they could do. They've got the money for $24 billion set aside for decommissioning reactors. They'd have to get legislation to give them permission to use it, but they don't want to do it because it's going to cost them more money.
Gotcha.
But it's going to cost a lot more if it makes an entire state uninhabitable and, you know, kills how many people? I don't know.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. Stephen Starr, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
If you don't come on, who's going to tell them, right?
Right.
we'll be in touch, and you take care, and thank you. We very much appreciate your work, and we appreciate having you with us tonight as our first-time guest. All right, man. Take care. All right, now. Well, I said it. If we don't tell you, who's going to? This is Coast to Coast AM, and Scott Portzline is next.